Good morning. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Joint Ways and Means Committee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Tuesday, March 14th, 2017. And I would like to open two public hearings once again this morning, Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 5517. And this morning, after it looks like a brief intro by Dr. Noor, we are going to be focusing on the Youth Development Council with Ira Bell. So, both of you, thank you and welcome.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Oregon Department of Education. And today's portion of our budget presentation focuses on the Youth Development Division. And I'm going to turn it over to Iris Bell, Director of the Youth Development Division, to share that budget portion of the presentation with you. I'm going to step away from the table because she has other staff members joining her. And we look forward to answering any questions that you may have for us. Thank you.
And for reference sake, this is, I think, page 303. Oop, there it is, up on the board.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, and members of the committee. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Director of the Youth Development Council. With me today is Anya Sacchino, who will be giving some information and budget information on our juvenile crime prevention funding, which basically has state general fund and federal funds attached to it, and Bill Hansel, who will be giving some background information on our youth and community grants. I'd like to first start off, some of you are quite familiar with the Youth Development Council. A few of you may not be. Representative Wisnett, I know you're intimately familiar with the council and its origins. So I'd like to start off with a little background on those origins and then come into the slide presentation. So as most of you may know, about 5 years ago, the Youth Development Council was created along with the Early Learning Council with funding that came from the abolished Commission on Children and Families system. Now, that funding was sort of divvied up, and the Early Learning Council received those funds that would necessarily be for young people 0 to 5, which was like the relief nursery funding and the Healthy Start funding that you're somewhat familiar with. And then the Youth Development Council received the funding that was for juvenile crime prevention. We also received the Title 20 Social Services Block Grant funding, which was some federal funding. And that's basically the origins of the funding that we had to actually start the Youth Development Council. We went into the governor's office for a year while we were developing and putting our program models together. And we came out in 2012 over to the Department of Education. When we came out with that very same funding, and we utilized that funding for our first year of actually putting grant and aid out to communities around the state. Since that time, we've had two bienniums go by, and during that process, we basically were maintained at current service level, and we find ourselves here now facing some reductions. So as I take you through and sort of lay out for you our mandates, our governance structure, and some of our roles and responsibilities, you will see that as we have developed, we have maintained and actually performed all of those functions. However, we have not necessarily gained any funding in that process. So just a little background for you on that. So we were established, as you can see, for the purpose of overseeing a system that had services for school-age children through age 24. Originally, that was age 20. That changed in the last biennium cycle. And that was to support educational success, to focus on crime prevention, and to look at how we could reduce high-risk behaviors. And we were to do that in an integrated and measurable way. And the council was to provide the direction to the division as we moved into the Department of Education. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we move through the slides. Our council mandate was an extension of that legislative mandate, and again, here's where the council began to take a look at its position and role within a education framework, and to begin to take a look at how we would look at administering policies for funding community-based organizations and school-based organizations around the areas of educational success and career and workforce development. And our emphasis was going to be through the focus of a positive youth development framework. And so, as you know, positive youth development sort of focuses on the resiliency factors of young people as they move through life. Our governance structure kind of takes us back again to the origins of the council itself. House Bill 4165, which back in 2012 actually established us, and again in House Bill 3231. Thank you. House Bill 3231, which further expanded our duties and responsibilities. 3231 actually charged us with coming up with a new way to fund and to actually invest in communities statewide. Originally, through the old commission system, the way in which funding was actually administered out was through the commissions on children and families at the county levels, and that was through a 0 to 17 population-based formula. So it had nothing to do with necessarily the way in which we are functioning now. Basically, whatever the population in your county was, 0 to 17, there was a formula that had been developed, and you were allocated those monies that went to the counties, and the counties then determined how those funds would be spent. In this new system, what we were able to do was to take a look at need, and we said we would develop a need-based system along with looking at equity. And so in a need-based system, we asked communities to take a look at what was happening with respect to various indicators that said there was need in their community, and to share with us that information, and along with looking at equity and how they were equitably looking at their populations in their communities. And that's the new way in which we went about distributing and making those investments. So now a little bit about the council itself. The council currently has 23 members who are appointed by the governor. At the same time, the council serves as Oregon's state advisory group. And the state advisory group is a requirement of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention and the Prevention Act itself that says that we have the authority based on the Department of Justice to actually take a look at how we prevent further penetration into the juvenile justice systems. So the council is tasked with ensuring compliance with four of the core protections for youth. And those four core protections are disproportionate minority contact, which has to do with the disparities in the system around young people who actually enter into the juvenile justice system. So for young people of color entering the system, the federal government asked us to keep an eye on that and to ensure that we are having some impact on what happens to those young people who enter into those systems and to try to keep them out of those systems. We're also responsible for sight and sound separation, and that means that no young person should ever be within sight or sound of an adult as they enter into the justice system. They can't even be sitting in the hallway in an adult institution in terms of, and we can be found out of compliance as a state, if indeed. So we monitor the state's juvenile systems as well as the state's sheriffs and police offices to ensure that no young person is within sight and sound of an adult. We also are responsible for looking at the deinstitutionalization of status offenses. And, of course, status offenses are your truancy, your runaway, your runaway kinds of situations, curfew, those sorts of things. And, of course, we're responsible to ensure that if a young person is found within the context of an adult system, that that we have those that young person removed from those particular systems. So further into our structure here. So we have several statutes that speak to how we as a division function within the context of the department. And basically, we function under the direction and control of the council itself. The governor appoints the director, and I'm responsible for the duties and the functions of the system itself. And I'm also responsible directly to the governor, the state superintendent of public instruction. One of the things that we spent, and the council has spent a great deal of time on, is looking at the value system that we would employ as we did the work. As I kind of move through these, you'll see that most of this is very youth-focused. For example, when we say youth inclusiveness, we're talking about ensuring that we have the perspectives of young people as we make the decisions that we make as a council. And to that end, we have five young people who sit on the council itself, all appointed by the governor. And so they actually are quite active in giving us input on the processes that and the policies and the discussions that we have. We also sought to ensure that there is access, and we look at things like equity and inclusion. We take those very, very seriously, and respect as well. We also recognize different forms of government. And here, as you look at that, when we're talking about the sovereignty of our tribal partners. And so as we have a tribal representative in statute on the council, we are informed on an ongoing basis as we look at our policies to ensure that we recognize that tribal sovereignty and that we engage in the tribes in a respectful manner with respect to that sovereignty. Of course, we look to fund our programs based on evidence and best practices. And we also look to ensure that we support our programs with promising practices and practice-based evidence, which is another sort of tribal way of taking a look at how we get to kind of programmatic aspects of success for tribal youth. We're results-oriented. There's systems thinking that goes into what we do. We also seek out innovation, particularly innovation and creativity in communities, primarily because those communities kind of know best what works for them and propose those ideas to us, and we support those ideas. We use, again, a positive youth development kind of framework as the foundation for how we look at our school engagement, our secure and career and workforce success, and our juvenile crime prevention. So in all three of those areas, that positive youth development framework, where we're looking at the resiliency factors of young people, is always taken into consideration. And of course, we also encourage a sustainable approach with respect to the communities that we engage, helping and suggesting that they leverage our kind of meager funds to help support the programs in their communities. And they have done an excellent job of taking the funding that we have administered and leveraging those funds in their communities to help support their young people. Duties and responsibilities, we have many. all of this, again, in statute that you all suggested would help to frame the work that we do. So we were charged with determining the availability of funding that supports community-based organizations. So we were charged with prioritizing that funding related to prevention and intervention services. We were also charged with entering into performance-based intergovernmental agreements. And that, again, looks back at the regional agreements, looks at county agreements, and, of course, our tribal government and our tribal agreements as well. We also were charged with determining the means by which those services to children and youth could be provided in effective and efficient manners across state systems. And we were also asked to assess state programs and services related to youth and development. And to that end, we produced a document that we've updated over time that really looks at state agencies that serve youth and how that funding and how those programs work and where there is alignment and continuity with those particular programs. And so we produced that particular report to the Oregon Education Investment Board, and now more recently to the Chief Education Office, which really looks at what is happening with state agencies in state government as they fund programs for children and youth. One particular note there is, as we looked, and it may not become as any surprise to any of you, but as we looked at those programs and we looked at where state funding actually is the greatest with respect to children and youth, the largest impact, the largest amount of general fund that we spend on youth is in our Oregon Youth Authority. So it's in our juvenile justice system. That's where we spend our general fund, the most general fund in all of our state agencies at the moment. So at this point, we also took a look at, and we've been trying to work on, how we establish some common academic and social indicators, and we've done that. We've developed a list of sort of indicators for communities that communities sort of take a look at as they begin to say, how are we going to focus in on a youth population, and how are we going to begin to address some of the concerns and problems that we may have with our youth in our community, particularly if we're looking for outcomes around educational success and career development. We've also been working quite for some time now on developing outcome measures for community-based programs as they try to align their work towards an educational kind of success focus. We also were charged with ensuring the implementation of evidence-based programs and practices, culturally and gender and age-appropriate practices. We also were supposed to build upon and improve health and well-being of young children. And that, of course, again, would include tribal best practices, because one of the things we really do is to take into consideration, and those tribal best practices also work for the larger general populations, as well as we take a look at how we are looking at improving the health and well-being of young people. We have another additional set of duties and responsibilities that come up related to juvenile crime prevention. And again, you're seeing the amount of responsibilities that we have are rather significant. And so Anya Sakino is going to sort of take you through the juvenile crime prevention duties and responsibilities spelled out in our statutes as well.
Thank you, Iris. Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. My name is Anya Sakino. I'm the Juvenile Crime Prevention Manager. The statute that defines the responsibilities of YDC around juvenile crime prevention, also known, lovingly known as JCP, not to be confused with JCPenney, has been pretty much intact since 1999, when the first legislature was initiated and enacted. Among the duties and responsibilities of the YDC for the juvenile crime prevention allocation fund, the council has to review the budget and allocation formula for appropriations for the purpose of juvenile crime prevention. The allocation formula is based on population. We receive updated information from Portland State University on the census prognosis for how many children reside in each county. Larger counties with larger population of kids go through the formula. We also establish minimum grant allocations for smaller counties and the 9 federally recognized tribes of Oregon. So we develop a funding policy that provides incentives for flexible programming and promotes strategies to stress reinvestment in youth. To help counties and tribes accomplish these, we develop a set of guidelines during each biennium for the planning purposes. So we're currently in the process of, actually right now we're expecting plans to come in. We've sent the guidelines earlier at the end of last year, and we're expecting plans to come in by the end of March, and then the Youth Development Council members will review the plans, and the approval process will happen at the next meeting in June. This is to allow for flexibility for local folks to implement practices and policies that work the best for them given the context of their community. And it's, the planning process involves a wide spectrum of community members, and one of the requirements of the local public safety coordinating councils must be a participating partner in the process and also have to sign off on the plan. So after that, we'll recommend high-risk juvenile justice and juvenile crime prevention policies to the governing the Legislative Assembly, so we might be back with that. We'll establish and publish review and assessment criteria for local high-risk juvenile crime prevention planning and ensure the criteria are met by state and local and private entities. So that process that went into the development of the guidelines involved some significant amount of work by the members of Youth Development Council, including Dr. Mary Arnold, who developed our strategies for a theory of action. What does it take? Why do children not get in trouble? And our theory is that through emphasizing positive youth development and building on resiliency of children, we will support them through school, through life, and therefore prevent crime. We'll ensure broad citizen involvement. I've mentioned that. And another thing is, we do work with tribal governments to develop high-risk juvenile crime prevention plans. So there is a specific portion of the allocation that goes directly to the 9 federally recognized tribes. So we work with tribal councils. We work with several tribes have their own prevention agencies. So that's a combination of physical health, mental health, risky behaviors type of services. In other areas, it goes through cultural departments, so it varies from tribe to tribe. So we review the components of high-risk juvenile crime prevention plans. As I mentioned, we expect to review them, and we'll receive them at the end of March and go through review in April. That ensures an accountability on our part. So although it is an allocation and every single county and every single tribe is eligible to receive the funds, there are some guidelines and criteria that the YDC sets around what these monies can be used for. And then once it's all approved and it looks good to go, then we will enter into contracts and intergovernment agreements with counties and tribes, and the process will begin, hopefully on July 1st. Thank you.
Co-Chairs Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bill T. Hansel, and thanks for being here this morning. In terms of our customers, what does that look like? The Youth Development Council's mandate is to focus on youth between the ages of 6 and 24. We have used naming conventions that follow the White House Council for Community Solutions, which identified 16 to 24-year-olds as opportunity youth. Specifically, those are youth that are out of school and not working. They decided to use the term opportunity youth as opposed to disconnected or disengaged youth because those youth represent a tremendous economic opportunity, lost economic potential, and two, and I think more importantly, when those youth were polled, asked for opportunities. So it was opportunities that they were looking for. The second population of the youth that the YDC serves are those 6 to 15 years old, and those can be thought of as the youth that are at risk of disengaging from the school system. Specifically, the number of youth that are served through our community investments, 5,000 in youth and juvenile crime prevention, 7,824 in our youth and community funds, 1,700 in youth and innovation grants, 339 youth and workforce, 495 in our youth and gangs, and 2,242 in the community schools. That's approximately totals about 17,500 youth served through our funding streams. The next slide. Oh, thank you. In our next slide, we'll review the goals. These are specifically goals that we have outlined for ourselves for the next biennium. They include to more fully realize the role envisioned by the legislature and our mandate to oversee a unified youth service system that is accountable for improving positive outcomes for all youth 6 to 24 years of age. What's unique in that is that that goal encompasses, as it says, all youth. And students are youth, but not all youth are students. That's one of the distinctions there. Another unique thing about our community strategies is that we can improve the program quality of the programs in the communities where these youth reside through our grant offerings. And that's an important, as we improve the quality of the program serving those youth in the communities, it follows that outcomes improve for those youth as well. Another goal is that the non-K-12 youth, particularly those aged 21 to 24, which was a new portion added in the last session to the youth that we serve, need a different, they've aged out of the K-12 system. So the focus there is on re-engagement or engagement with workforce and post-secondary education, higher education. Another goal is that we will create stronger synergies.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Hansel. Wouldn't one of the goals for those 21 to 24-year-olds be to get them in a GED program and get their high school equivalency if they haven't already received it?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, thank you for the question. And yes, that is one. And that we link that in the higher education because ultimately the goal of the GED is to connect them to the career opportunities either through the community colleges that will allow for the job development and training and the type of basic credential that allows for employment. So you're absolutely correct. A GED and ultimately you hope not as a terminal offering, but as something that will open doors for them down the road.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, follow up. When I was on the board of Mount Hood Community College, I know I went to their graduation every year, and one of the biggest, most interesting groups of graduates were the GED graduates, those that had gotten their GED at the community college, and they could be anywhere from late teens to 50 something. And it was interesting to see the joy on their faces when they got their high school equivalency. It's pretty important.
Absolutely. Yep. Moving along.
Excuse me, okay. Senator Roblin.
I just want to make a follow-up on that because I am absolutely supportive of GED. We have to get the kids there because of the other. But the newest reports out say that that's not enough. And getting them connected to the community college so they get that extra training is really what makes a difference because their performance out in society pretty much matches kids without a high school diploma. So they don't quite get up to that high school diploma level without interventions and doing some other things to get them back into a system that helps them. But those that do it at the community college already have that.
Yes.
Kind of interest, they're already there, which has really been a big asset to community college. So thank you.
Representative Fernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Question about the goals. Are they, are these goals more like visionary goals that you have every year? They look very different from kind of like the key indicator goals. That are more measurable and specific?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Hernandez. Yes, there are. It's the council's aspirational goals. These are the goals that we seek to try and frame our work around. They're not, you're right, they're not the sort of performance sort of based measurement goal, but it's the goals for how we actually sort of begin to engage and sort of fully expand out our legislative mandates with respect to what we've been charged with doing.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Do these goals get updated annually or every other year, or is it, or do they just stay the same?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Fernandez, yes, they do. The council does review these, and we do this in a retreat-type setting where we actually go back and through our retreat process go over, update, even look at the values that we have put forth and begin to say, how do we continue to work on aligning our goals and objectives with the goals and objectives that have been set out in our mandates and our statutes by the legislature? And how then do we further advance the information that we've obtained from communities? Because as we go out into communities, that also informs our goals as we move forward.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Thank you for the questions. I do believe that it also illustrates that these goals are examples of how our role fulfills the portion of the unified system and is in collaboration with the work of the Department of Ed. And for example, the next one, as you can see, for the 6 to 24-year-olds, particularly those in school, we identify these transitional periods as key transitions where the youth are often lost, and that's an area that we can focus on. We, again, by guiding our community investments, we can specifically focus on community-based organizations that are supporting those transitions, whether it be from elementary to middle school, the middle school to high school, the high school to community or college, higher education, and career. Also, a primary goal is to advocate for those youth that are in the margins between engagement, disengagement, and re-engagement. And that's a big area of support, is to both to help prevent youth that are at risk of disengaging, and then to bring the youth that have disengaged back into the supportive systems. And finally, in collaboration with legislatures, youth, community, education, and workforce stakeholders, the YDC will develop a plan that operationalizes a statewide re-engagement system. That's a big goal for us. That's encapsulated in House Bill 2657, which is re-engagement, a plan for out-of-school youth, to establish a task force and then develop a plan on what it would actually look like to begin to bring back the current estimated 59,000 youth that are currently out of work and out of school in Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, could you go back to slide 313? Just one slide. I mean, Mike's years on the Commission for Children and Families, we always talk about early learning, but we've got a 250,000 people, youth here. When you add the 59 and 200,000, 250,000 people that need help. And, you know, the budget's small and we're serving only 17,000. It's more glamorous, and I think early prevention, we all agree that saves, but this is a population that really needs help and is going to be a drain on society. We really need to focus more on this group. I don't know how you do it. I'd ask the director, Mrs. Bell, are we really helping? You went from 20 to 24 years old. That group of people, how can we really, you know, help that group of people in this, and with the money and staff that you have? You have one person in gang prevention.
Right.
And gangs are where these kind of youths go because that's their brotherhood. I've been briefed on some of your programs. I think one of the most effective groups or mentors for this group, this age group, is their peers. Mm-hmm. And I think some of your programs, you've talked about how you're using some peers to help turn these youth around. But this is something we don't focus enough on as a legislature, I believe. And I think it really does drain on society, and I don't know how we solve the problem. I don't have a solution, but we just sort of go over this. But it's it is a drain, I think, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And you might ask the director then, you know, are you having any success? Is this taking a lot of your time when you went up to the, you know, you increased the age group? I've said on this committee a couple times that thank God our son turned out like he did, but we kicked him out at 18. I mean, gave him enough money for college and go do your thing. So.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Wisnett. Yes, I do believe we are having an impact on that larger group. Right now we have some pilot programs that are out that are actually engaging that particular age group. And, you know, contrary to popular sort of belief, 21 to 24 doesn't necessarily mean that they have matured to the point where they can engage these systems, particularly if they don't have the soft skills development, you know, those basic concepts around work or around college or career. And so many of the programs that we're funding now are basically programs that look at soft skill development, getting to work on time, getting up, being able to engage in the workforce in a positive manner. So we are actually funding a few programs right now that are developing those soft skills for 21 to 24 year olds, because they lack those skills, and that is one of the reasons why we don't see them in the workforce or actually even going on to college, because they don't have the particular skills that they need. One of the things that we've looked at as we've sort of looked around the state is that where we have our employment agencies that are community-based, we are looking at the possibility and making recommendations that they have internal to those agencies a place where young people, youth, can go to seek out employment skills and seek out employment support outside of that sort of mainstream adult system. Yes, in age 21 to 24, they're, quote, adults, but they still need some of those supports that will help them to be successful. And so we're looking at those kinds of solutions. And that's primarily where our workforce effort is. How do we help support those young people in those communities? How do we help them to get that soft skill development so that they can move on? So that's where we're kind of making that particular emphasis. But you're right about another point as well. There are a number of young people who are not 0 to 5, who need our support and need us to sort of step up. And as we go through some of the slides around our funding, you will find that we don't have a lot of general fund invested in these young people.
Thank you. I look forward to getting to that, Senator Roblin.
And going from 20 to 24 matched us with the federal government's recommendations and did
Absolutely.
Bring in some more resources, not from the state, but from the federal government,
yes.
is my understanding.
Yes.
And I was talking to some medical people the other day, and they said that truthfully the flexibility of the brain and brain development, we really shouldn't stop thinking of people as fully developed until after 24. So there's a whole lot of science that goes to this is the time when they still can. It's the time to keep them away from addictive behaviors because it's much harder after that 24 to get caught up in those kinds of things. So I hope we can figure out ways, I agree with Representative Wisnett, to find ways to fund this more, because you're right, that's 250,000 youth and people who probably are going to be as costly as any to society as time goes on. So I agree. We just have to figure out what that looks like. And hopefully we got this group to help us figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
Oops, I have to go. Okay. So here is where we sort of get into discussion of how our funding actually exists. So our legislatively approved budget is $25.1 million total funds. The majority of that, our largest component of that, where you see the $15.4 million, exists with respect to our juvenile crime prevention funds, which is our largest funding. And then our youth and community and innovation funding is in there, along with some of our operational funding. If you take a look at our federal funds, that's our Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention funding that we get from the federal government. And then our other funds, this $6.1 million, is also Social Service Block Grant Title 20 funding, which is also federal funding. So if you take a look at what's happening, almost sort of try to draw a line down the middle of this pie, a significant amount of the money that we get is federal funding. And I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about the fact that even in this last year, there was a sequestration of some of our social service block grant funds, and the legislature was good enough to backfill that to the extent, I think it was about $600,000. And so as we take a look at how the Youth Development Council is funded and how we are able to provide those investments in the community, a significant amount of that money is still federal. And that's something that I would want this particular committee to be aware of. So how that actually breaks down on this next page is, as you can see, our administration is very small. We have our juvenile crime prevention dollars and operations and gang prevention dollars in our operations. And then you'll see our grants and our programs. And again, as I said, our juvenile crime prevention funding is the largest amount of funding. And let me just say, as Anya mentioned, back as far as, 1990s, when we first got these funds, that was $20 million. And so over the years, you've seen how we've gone from about $20 million. Now we're down to this $5.8 million for juvenile crime prevention. And those funds were really, at that time, spent throughout the communities and were really supporting and bolstering up communities that were trying to engage young people. And we still continue to do that. However, as you can see, those funds have really diminished over time. You will see that our FTE, we right now 8.75 FTE, as you can see. So 5 years, originally, I think we started out with about 7 FTE. We sort of made it up to 8.5. We don't have a lot of staff. We don't have a lot of funding, but we do have really some passion for these young people. And so our staff works very hard to ensure that we are engaging with communities, that we are making those investments, that the communities engage with us, and that we know what we can do to help support them. And we also help them to talk about how they leverage the funding that we get. So we're going to talk a little bit about our budget drivers, and one of them is an up-and-coming budget driver that has to do with our re-engagement of opportunity youth. And so Bill's going to talk a bit more about that, and then Anya's going to talk about our juvenile crime prevention budget driver as well.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, this is where we get into some of those financial numbers that were alluded to earlier. Specifically, the opportunity youth that the White House Council on Community Solutions came up with. And one thing I'd like to point out is that that council was not established as a youth serving, had nothing to do with youth service, actually. It was a council established to look at economic drivers for communities, for community revitalization. And they independently arrived at the number one priority was opportunity youth, these 16 to 24-year-olds out of work and out of school, because the return on investment there was the most significant for these communities. As we see here in Oregon, about one in every 8 youth is an opportunity youth. Of that age population, specifically about 460,000 youth between 16 and 24 in the state, of which 59,000 are not in school and not working. And based on work up by Belfield, Levin, and Rosen, that immediate tax burden per year is over $566 million to the state per year. If you throw in what they call the social burden, that raises to $2.2 million, billion dollars, excuse me. So as you can see, that is a big budget driver for us, because we believe that what the effect that we have not only stimulates communities economically in that we are investing in communities, but we are investing in these youth that are otherwise potentially going to represent extreme costs. So as we're able to reinvest them, and especially in times where budget concerns are necessary, we can considerations are necessary, we can do more with less, and the impact is significant.
Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe. Now let's go back to the juvenile crime prevention. The goal of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Program is to assist state and local efforts to prevent juvenile crime and reduce youth involvement with justice system through implementation of effective evidence-based, research-based, and practice-based prevention intervention approaches. In other words, all these efforts are really to increase quality of life in communities, to make communities safe, to make kids feel safe going to school, coming back from school, and feeling safe in the home. We've measured the success and sometimes failures of the programs for a number of years. The first available evaluation that was done by NPC Research dates back to the 2005-2007 biennium. The numbers that you see here are the most current one, but I just wanted to illustrate to you that we've been tracking the results for a number of biennia now. How do we know that there's changes made in youth behavior? There was a juvenile crime prevention assessment tool developed in 2002 by NPC Research and the Oregon Juvenile Directors Association, and it has been implemented since. It is also, it was validated a couple of years ago as one of the most reliable assessment tools in the nation. The assessment measures risk in five different areas, including school failure. And this is how we know, so children who enter the programs funded by JCP dollars are assessed at the point of entry to determine whether first they're eligible for the services and also what type of services would be most appropriate to them. And they're reassessed again at either the end of the program or at 6 months, depending the length of the program. One of the areas is school engagement, as I told you before. So within that area, several different aspects are being measured, including truancy and dropout. So this is the result here of our latest evaluation available, which is for biennium 13-15. Our current biennium is not over yet, so the next evaluation should be ready by the end of this calendar year in December. So I would present to you that JCP programs actually have an influence on education. So our assessment have shown, and we've assessed, this is based on 3,387 children. 56% of these youth had at least one issue in the school domain in the initial assessment. So we'll suggest we'll divide 3,387 youth by half. So you'll still get a significant number of kids. So out of these kids, 43% of them showed a decrease in academic failure at reassessment, which is significant. 51% of you showed a decrease in chronic truancy at reassessment, which is, I believe, to be a significant improvement. And 68% of these youth showed a decrease in school dropout of reassessment. And in very bold font, you can see the difference in a price tag, in a way. We estimate that per youth, our average investment in an individual child is about $600 per year. And again, it varies because the different programs are being implemented, and some are a little more costly than others. And in contrast with that, none of our programs will ever come up to the amount I'm quoting for you here, and this is based on the information I forgot from Oregon News Authority. This is the cost of keeping one youth per 1 year in close custody in one of OYA facilities. That's $146,000 per year. This is huge.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
That's an incredible statistic. We invest $600 and save $146,000. Looks like we ought to be concentrating more on the front end.
Representative Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, this is what we've been saying, and this is why this is such a budget driver for us. The juvenile crime prevention programs actually are very effective, and they work. And we work closely with the juvenile department directors in the counties around the state. They then are able to identify those programs in their community that keep kids out of their systems. And that is one of their primary goals as well, to keep young people out of these systems. And to do so really does give us a return on our investment. But again, as I've been saying, we've seen over the years how the funding for juvenile crime prevention has been reduced. And I know that those juvenile department directors have been in the building expressing their concern about that as well. So as we go on here, you will see then here comes our current service level. Not that different from our 2015-17 legislatively approved budget. Here comes our 2017-19 current service level budget. So basically, we've been pretty stagnant when it comes to the amount of funding that we have been receiving over quite a period of time. But this is sort of where we are here now, same kind of sort of configuration, and again, same kinds of concerns about the fact that those federal funds could definitely begin to go away, and the need for us to really take a look at how we're going to support young people with our state general fund. If you take a look at what this means in terms of our current service level budget, again, you'll see where our funding is. It goes up just a bit, and that's basically due to inflation and some other sort of drivers there, but it's basically the same budget. So now we sort of get into that sort of operations overview, and you can kind of see where the funding actually is in our budget. In operations, we have $4.1 million and nine FTE. And with that, we basically pay for our supports for the Department of Ed, our back office functions. We do our community engagement strategies. We also support the council with those funds. And you will see then our juvenile crime prevention program has three FTE and about $1.1 million there for that. And then our gang prevention program has one FTE and $1 million invested there. Then you're going to see our organizational structure. It's not that complicated. We take a look at the fact that there are nine of us attempting to do this work. So that's our kind of operations overview. And now Bill's going to take you basically through each of our programs here with respect to our youth investments and our youth and community grants. This is where we are actually putting our funding into the community through these particular grant programs.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. As you can see here, the current service level is at about $22 million. That is also striking to me in terms of the number that was thrown out earlier. We're reaching approximately 17,500 youth with this number. 59,000 youth are out of school, out of work, at an estimated cost of $566 million per year to the state. In tax burden alone. So as we move through this, we have what are called the youth and community grants, $9.2 million in funds. These youth and community grants reach communities specifically. We know that youth are not raised in programs, they're not raised in schools, they're raised in families, and those families comprise communities, and that's what we look to reach these youth by targeting their local communities. We awarded 56 grants in total through three tiers of funding, and the primary distinction between the tiers of funding is the amount. What this slide doesn't show is that we had 32 programs, community-based organizations that we were unable to fund. We expect that number only to increase because both our community engagement efforts and word of mouth has increased over the last biennium. In fact, our outreach efforts, if successful, drive up that number. So we're in a situation where we actually expect more competitive grant applications and a greater number of applications for a smaller pool of funding. As you can see in the bottom slide there, the governor's recommended budget reduces the current service level by $330,000+. Our youth and innovation grants on the next slide are approximately $3.1 million in general funds. What's unique about the youth and innovation grants is that's where we can target innovation within the community. So for example, if there is something new that is wanting to be tried, perhaps the GED Plus or the new connection or building out an opportunity to support youth in community college as part of earning a high school diploma or GED or any number of innovative things. This is where we have the ability to be very nimble and to allow for trials of these type of effective things that can then scale up and ideally move into the youth and community grants upon being able to show effectiveness. As you can see again down here at the bottom bullet, the reduction is about over $500,000. Our youth and innovation grants from the last biennium, we've actually carved out from the total amount of the youth and innovation what we now call youth and workforce. This specifically addresses the 21 to 24-year-olds because of the different needs that they may have than the other population, and targets specifically programs around workforce support, both in the soft skills training and in actual job trainings that allow for employment and career orientation specifically. That bottom slide again indicates about a $50,000 cut to those programs.
Could you give an example of one of those specifically, one of these grants, the youth and workforce?
Sure. So the youth and workforce by design targets the workforce component, and within that then, for example, there are ones that in the previous biennium, because we didn't have this carve out, they were served as part of the youth and community grants, and that's what I can speak to as that's the grants that I manage. But specifically, they would be there's one in Wallowa County, for example, Building Healthy Families, that specifically targets soft skill development. In other words, what are the skills that are necessary? Soft skills are like the paying attention when spoken to, the kind of the eye contact thing, the distinction between what's appropriate to wear to a job interview or how to present yourself, some things like that may actually benefit jobs. Other ones can be like apprenticeship programs. We've had interaction with a variety of unions that are saying, hey, we're actually looking for apprentices. It's a model that's coming back because it very closely resembles what's now called mentoring, but effectively an apprenticeship is a mentoring program.
Right. And so there were five specifically in this. I guess, how would you argue that it makes more, like, what is the advantage of having it come through this versus come through somewhere else, whether it's, whether it's employment or whatever it is? Like, what's the advantage of having it come through the Youth Development Council?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, the advantage I think that we bring is the community engagement component of this. We really do work specifically with on the ground in the community. So this is almost like a grassroots build-up component. So the programs that we are investing in are programs that the community has indicated are needed. And we don't go in with, we're here to help you. Here's the program that we're going to give you. We sit and we talk with community and we engage community. We get the information back from the community. They tell us what they need, and then we work with them to make that investment. That's a very significant difference in the way in which most of the funding and the allocations go out to communities from the state. And we have gotten a lot of feedback from that, saying that they're appreciative of the fact that we are willing to work with those communities, particularly the tribal communities as well, to help develop. And we negotiate with those communities around that. So we spend a lot of time out with the community, engaging the community. And I think that makes all the difference in the world in terms of how then when we actually end up investing or giving out, allocating a grant, what that means in terms of the kinds of outcomes we get from that. We get a much better positive outcome when we have that kind of relationship.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I can also speak to the fact that we have the ability, like this one was a much smaller carve-out. This was really a trial period that we're opening up for the new biennium to fully expand. But some of the things that we can do are, like, target innovation, entrepreneurship, and call out a very specific portion of, like, what does youth entrepreneurship look like? Can we support, perhaps more trendy, of the immediate type of things that are gaining traction, we can address, with much more nimbly sometimes in a broader thing. The other thing, as Senator Roblin pointed out, there's monies that are coming from federal dollars, but those have certain restrictions, and sometimes communities find there are youth that would benefit greatly from this type of program, but there's one type of exclusionary standard, that has to be met, that cannot be met, that makes them eligible for federal dollars, and that's where we can step in and assist, really, by allowing or funding those particular youth to participate very similarly without that restriction.
Great,
applied.
Thank you. So we have about 10 minutes left, and I think we're on track to finish, but I just wanted to give you that time check. Okay.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. Now we're going back to the juvenile crime prevention. And since I already spent quite a bit of time talking about improvements in school domain, I will not go over it again. It's still the same numbers. But one important thing about juvenile crime prevention out here I would offer to you is the way to measure overall success in our key performance measure around that particular funding stream is crime prevention or reduction in recidivism, depending on the youth. So based on our latest evaluation available, 82% of kids who participated in the program and who were not offenders, meaning they were not referred to the program after committing a crime, 82% of them did not commit any crime within 12 months after the end of the program. 72% of those kids who did have a prior referral, who had committed a crime before, did not receive additional referral or did not recidivate within 12 months upon the completion of the service. And this is an important outcome. Keep that in mind when we talk about reduction in funds on the next page. We also have seen significant reduction in funds from the federal government that used to be used by local juvenile departments to support their prevention services as well, and I believe there will be a slide about that further on. So our federal funds focus pretty much on the same things, which is delinquency prevention and intervention activities used to reduce risk factors in kids. We serve with the state advisory group, as Iris mentioned. So currently, our federal funds are dedicated to four distinct funding areas. First one is school programs, and this is to promote educational supports and services. The project that we're currently funding is physically based in Yamhill County Detention, which is used by both Yamhill and Poe counties. Interestingly enough, Multnomah Education Service District is the education agency that provides services there. So our capstone project in that area, which is over with the help from Georgetown University School of Center for Juvenile Justice Reform, is to ensure transition from juvenile detention back into regular schools for every single child who has been detained in that facility. And so far what I'm hearing back, it's going really well because there is a significant difficulty for children to go back from detention to their regular school. I'm generalizing, but overall they're not exactly welcome back. So they need some transitional help to help them navigate that. And part of it actually was an interesting thing. DHS is also involved, and the research project that's associated with that will be to look at whether additional supports will play a role in successful transition back to school, because that transition is also supporting families in the process. Sometimes kids don't have shoes to go to school, so our program can support with that. So I'm really excited about that when I spend a little more time than I probably should have on that. Our diversion programs are actually peer courts. You've mentioned peer supports and peer guidance. Some kids who commit little offenses in schools get in a fight with another student, take a phone, something like real low-level offense, which does not usually create high risk for society. These cases are handled by peer courts and the supervision of real judges, real attorneys, but all of them volunteer. And we have a variety of programs like that in different areas. Jefferson County has been doing it for years, and so has Yamhill, and we were able to award additional grants to some programs in Portland, Gresham area, and also in Tillamook. Addressing disproportionate minority contact is a federal requirement where the agency responsible for monitoring over-representation of children of color in the juvenile justice system. And we're also required to monitor compliance with the federal act. This is where we inspect law enforcement facilities, jails, prisons, stuff like that. The governor's budget, if, as it stands right now, would reduce our general fund by $1,021,670, which would result in loss of services for about 846 youths. I don't want to generalize and make a correlation that doesn't exist necessarily, but it could produce an increase in crime. Now, the JCP federally funded programs already went through that. We also have gang prevention type services that are funded by, were funded a year ago that one ended. That's why I didn't mention it sooner. But the significant investment is in school programs. You've also passed money on to the nine tribes. Now, the general fund, which is probably perhaps of more interest to you, can be describe the, again, like different types of, is based on the community need. This does not represent necessarily each particular community, but this is overall statewide how communities decide to invest. So for instance, school-based services, which is a significant chunk of JCP funding, for instance, Washington County puts all of their JCP funds into schools. So Hillsborough area and Beaverton school districts all have special school-based counselors that work with kids who need additional help, who demonstrate risky behaviors at school, so they don't get propelled further on into the juvenile justice system, but can be worked with in school by specially trained counselors, taking the burden off the teachers in that. We support tribal best practices. We worked with the tribes to recognize that their cultural traditions are, in fact, prevention. So part of the things that we support was tribal youth, our canoe journeys, the healing of canoe, healing circles, and stuff like that. We do have an investment in mentoring and diversion restorative justice programs. That's a combination of peer courts as well as restorative justice programs. And these are all school-based. They don't fall under school-based services necessarily, but they are school-based as well. And we do have a significant investment in behavioral health type services. That would be functional family therapy and other family therapy type things for recognizing that the child does not exist by him or herself, themselves. There are families involved.
Okay, so last but not least of our programs is our community schools grant, which is quite a small grant. This was a program that was started back with the Commission on Children and Families, and as we transitioned, this program transitioned with us. It has not grown, but it still stays basically current with respect to the amount of funding we have for it. We actually fund several sites, and the sites that we fund, this is where you really see how schools can leverage some funding here. These schools absolutely appreciate the meager funds that we give. Some of these schools in some of these areas, for example, Riddle Middle School, it's become the hub for all the activities around community schools, and they've basically said to us, without this little bit of funding, we would not have a place for our parents to gather. We would not have a coordinator that brings together the programs that take a look at things like developing a school food bank or developing a clothing exchange program. So a little bit of money, but goes a long, long way with respect to what happens. And this funding has remained with us, and we continue to fund these school sites, and they continue to say to us, without these real meager amounts of funds, they couldn't do some of the things that they were doing in their communities. So now we're coming here to the last part of this. Governor's recommended budget here, and basically what happens here is that the governor's recommended budget is a 12% reduction in our current funding, and that comes to about $2 million. So at this point, we have about $2 million in the governor's sort of recommended budget for the 17-19 year, a reduction that would impact basically all of the services that we're doing right now. So as I move on, I'm trying to go rather quickly here. So we talk about our major sort of challenges and changes. One of them, for sure, is our regional engagement system strategy that we're trying to build. We see this really as a significant movement for this state towards re-engaging young people who are not in school and not working. There is a national movement around this. We had a delegation that went to Colorado just recently and represented the state of Oregon around this particular matter of re-engagement, and we see it as one of the major challenges going forward. We think that we do have a House bill that will look at how we move forward with re-engagement, but we think that our contribution to the educational system and the role that the YDC can play is around really continuing to move forward with how we re-engage young people who are not in school and not working in this state. And so, let's see, this is my last slide. And finally, our LFO general fund reduction impact, a 15% impact actually represents about a $2.4 million reduction for us. And so, as I have said, as we, over the past 5 years, have sort of moved forward, we've moved forward with no significant funding. I think we got about $2.6 million worth of funding from the legislature that added to our youth and community grant during the last biennium. However, we're at a point here with respect to the Youth Development Council and our moving forward where we really do need to see some growth if we are to expand in our ability to reach communities and to make a difference. And we really do see that we are making that difference. We just need, as Representative Wisnett has stated, we really do need the support of the legislature to move forward with some of the things that we are working on and doing. So with that, I would thank you for having us here today and hope to look forward to what you can do to support the council. Thank you so very much.
Thank you all. Any final questions? Anyone? Okay. Thank you all so much for presenting today. And with that, tomorrow, the next 2 days, we will be in Hearing Room F for public testimony. Tomorrow's testimony will be on the Youth Development Council and the Early Learning Division. And then Thursday, we'll focus on the State School Fund in general.
K-12.
So come with your listening ears on. And with that, I will close both Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 5517. And without further ado, I will close the meeting.